Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uridgewood.org.
There's a slight change from the announced title. It's Humanists and Christians, parenthesis, Unitarians, all, close parenthesis, comma, walking together. The comma is important. I learned to understand poetry by diagramming sentences. Grammar counts. You may have read the article in the Times this week about Robert Gottlieb, the book editor in New York, with some comments between him and Toni Morrison and their arguments about commas. How many there should be. We're not going to worry about commas anymore from this point on. Yes. Until the next piece of written material has to go out. I'm going to quote briefly from the book of Amos in the Hebrew Scriptures. Can two walk together unless they be agreed? Can two walk together unless they be agreed? This is a verse that is often used by religious conservatives to insist on doctrinal conformity. That one must agree to be able to walk in good faith with others. The late church historian C. Conrad Wright, a lifelong Unitarian and Unitarian Universalist, has written several essays in which he argues why that is not the case. Except for the fact that it's true. People must be agreed, but it's not necessarily on doctrinal matters. There has to be something that enables a community to walk together, a group of people to walk together as a religious community. And by walking together, I mean being in this space, working together for the sustenance of this community, for the welfare of our children, for the values we want to see in the world. And we do not have creeds, but neither then do some other religions of Protestant origin. That indeed many of the early Congregational Church covenants of New England refer not to specific beliefs about God or Jesus, but about walking together as God has revealed his way to us, which is not the same thing as saying exactly the way it's written in Genesis, whatever. And that, of course, is one of the historical secrets about how so many Congregationalist churches went from Trinitarian to Unitarian without having to split off into other organizations. The Unitarians just came numerous enough to take over. But walking together is important. And Wright, who was one of my teachers when I was in school and lived to the ripe old age of 94, dying just a few years ago, Wright made it very clear that there had to be some kind of consensus for people to walk together. Not necessarily an agreement on a set of beliefs, but a consensus on the values and practices that guided their life together as a religious community. And developing that consensus was important, and it was an ongoing process, and it would change through history. But there were three important points to it. The first was avoid making trivial matters part of the binding consensus. There are little things that will change over time, and they're not the ones to decide who's in and who's out on the basis of. And part of the consensus that we have is what we have agreed to disagree about. And if you look at the Unitarian Statement of Purposes and Principles as a kind of consensus for the whole association, you see there are definitely spaces in there that acknowledge disagreements as well as agreements. And the third, that consensus is created, sustained, and developed by the persons who have chosen to walk together. It is not like ancient doctrines or scriptures handed down. A consensus may be inherited, but it has to be revived, revitalized, restated, generation to generation. Now, because that could be done with open-ended church covenants in colonial New England, the founding documents could have space for a changing consensus. And some of the New England churches use the same covenants they had in the 1600s. And they're very Unitarian now. They have humanists, they have Christians, they have Buddhists, they have pagans, and they can still use those early covenants because they were so open. Not all of them were, but we won't be talking about covenants more this morning. But it is important to note that whatever consensus we have is the outgrowth of change and sometimes great disputes. First with Unitarians and to a lesser extent with Universalists with the dominant Christian churches or the established churches, and controversies within and disputes within. What is known as a Unitarian controversy in the early 1800s is what forced the split of the New England congregational churches into Trinitarian and Unitarian. It was a reluctant split on the part of the Trinitarians, on the part of the Unitarians, it was a reluctant split. On the part of the Trinitarians, they were happy to see us go, except in the Dedham Court case, the court decided the property could go with the Unitarians if they were the majority of the membership. But the disputes, the Unitarian controversy, a reluctant split among the Unitarians, because William Ellery Channing and others, the leaders of that time, using the gift of reason to apply it to the revealed scriptures that they had received, came to different conclusions than the standing order had come to before, or the Protestant churches, or the Catholic churches had come to before. But they saw no reason why different understandings of scriptures that had been handed down over centuries needed to divide people. They were ready to stake out areas of disagreement which could be part of the consensus. And they could be about something as important as the nature of God. Because, as historians note, the real dividing issue was the nature of humanity, whether humanity was inherently sinful or not. That was the real dividing line. So that was about defining who was in and who was outside. What were the boundaries of the churches? And then within the Unitarian movement, as it developed independently in the 1840s and 50s, you had the rise of what was known as absolute religion, first articulated by Theodore Parker. That said, the religion of these churches is not necessarily the revealed religion of the Christian scriptures, which most Unitarians adhered to, even if they interpreted them generously and liberally. But the truths that are embodied, which are embodied in other ways and stated in other ways, and which we know are true not because they're in an ancient scripture, but because our consciences can see that they're true. That there is a moral sentiment, that's a phrase the Unitarians of that time like to use, a moral sentiment inherent in every person that could discern right and wrong. And the ancient scriptures would be a guide to doing it better and to provide inspiration, not to define what was right or wrong, because we all had the capacity to do that. So the basic consensus that developed was one that over time, because there were more controversies, expanded who could be part of a Unitarian church. After the absolute religion controversy in the 1840s and 50s, you had the starting of the Free Religious Association, in which Unitarian ministers explicitly said they were not Christian. They were still theists, but they said they were not Christians. And then we had this obscure bit of history called the yearbook controversy as to which ministers would be listed in the Unitarian yearbook and which would not. and in which some of the non-Christian ministries asked not to be listed, and some complained when they weren't listed. And in 1933, the Humanist Manifesto, a statement of scientific atheistic humanism, and the majority of the signers were Unitarian ministers, though there were some others from ethical culture and outside of organized religion altogether. And that became a force for humanism in various forms, not just atheistic humanism, but also a religious humanism that had some sense of spirit, if not supernatural being, to become, over the next couple of generations, the majority identity of Unitarians and Unitarian Universalists. So much so that in 1945, the Unitarian Christian Fellowship was formed to maintain the vitality of Christianity within Unitarianism, not to deny the presence of humanism, but to sustain the vitality as part of the movement. And as the historian says, these were not so much arguments about doctrine as about who is in and who is out. How wide does our community extend? So walking together is not always easy. We have congregations that are overwhelmingly humanist, congregations that are majority but not overwhelmingly humanist. We have Christian congregations, several of which use this, the King's Chapel Book of Common Prayer. King's Chapel was the first church to identify itself as Unitarian. It was called King's Chapel because that is where the King of England would worship if he came to the colonies. It was the seat of the Church of England in the colonies. And at the conclusion of the War of Independence, when the Archbishop of Canterbury refused to send them a minister, partly because of the War of Independence, and partly because in the absence of an ordained clergy, their theology had strayed a bit, the congregation appointed a lay reader, James Freeman, and then ordained him as a minister on their own authority. And they wrote this prayer book, which reads like the Book of Common Prayer in the Anglican Church, but is strictly Unitarian in its theology. So God is in there, but Jesus is a teacher or a prophet, not one with God the Father. So instantly, King's Chapel became, well, almost instantly, but in that decision to ordain James Freeman, became Unitarian, congregational, having been hierarchical before, Unitarian, congregational, and its own place. And it remains Anglican in its worship style to this day. This is the 9th edition of the prayer book that I have. But walking together is not always easy. And indeed, how we worship, which is a word which is contested in humanist congregations, but let's just use it as a sociological functional term today. How we worship, how we gather together in Sunday services, how we celebrate our values and shared consensus, is a major factor in sustaining the consensus. Not only by offering up aspects of the consensus for celebration, as we do, for instance, in our chalice lighting words, but also by putting forth the particular religious identities of the people present. So an example of that is today's service, which has both Christian and humanist identities built into it as two religious traditions that are represented in this congregation. I discovered at the Unitarian Universalists of Clearwater, where I was interim before I came here, that this what it presented itself as a stridently, avowedly humanist, atheistic congregation, a good 15, maybe 20% of its members were liberal Christians, which is a sizable minority. But their voices could not be heard in that culture. The consensus was not working as well as it could. Though the Buddhist groups had an easier time being heard, and they were a much smaller number in that congregation. But there were 3 Buddhist groups, and they were well heard. Though they were not 15 or 20% of the membership. So it's how we behave, how we identify ourselves, and how we worship helps define who we are and how well we live the consensus we have come to. And the importance of the continuity of styles of worship is something that Conrad Wright spoke to in a different essay than the one I mentioned earlier. And he talked about how in the first church in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which his family had been members of probably since the War of Independence, they had a style of worship that was fairly traditional, but not at all like that at King's Chapel. It was traditional congregational worship. The hymn sandwich, a couple of prayers, a couple of readings. Not high liturgy. But that tradition, he argued, is what helped bind the congregation together, even though it included Christians, humanists, Buddhists, people of various practices, because it tied them to the past and united them in the present, and it evolved over time. It could change, but it didn't ever all change at once. That worship was a binding force, the building of solidarity, as he put it, the solidarity within the community. He makes the argument that King's Chapel never would have survived because of the disruptions of the revolution, sociological changes in Boston, the movement of its long-term elite members to the suburbs, had the prayer book not united people of a liberal Christian perspective in a liturgy that they found meaningful and that affirmed their beliefs as liberal Christians. There is an intellectual contact, Wright wrote to, in commenting on the Apostles' Creed, for instance, but there is also its social meaning. The message conveyed is that human solidarity means more than divisive issues in theology. So I had briefly rehearsed that history of dispute within the liberal religious movement that began as liberal congregationalists in New England. But also an important piece of it is the efforts to define America as a Christian, explicitly Christian culture in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, of which I'll say more in a few weeks, was part of the force, I think, that pushed, and the growth of fundamentalism, which didn't exist basically before 1900, pushed people of more liberal and scientific and rationalistic persuasions to be much more assertive about their humanism, and even at times to be hostile to liberal Christianity, which if fundamentalism was here and humanism was here, you know, the humanists and liberal Christians were about that far apart. And they're all way far apart from the fundamentalists, because the liberal Christians used rationality. When William Ellery Channing preached on Unitarian Christianity most conducive to piety, he made the rational argument that the particular teachings of Unitarianism encouraged and empowered individuals to be more deep in their piety and worship and love of God than Trinitarianism did. And that's a long and complex discussion. The long and short of it is, if Jesus is human, he's a much more challenging figure than if he's God, and you take his teaching seriously. So I see both intellectual and moral integrity in both liberal and Unitarian Christianity and in religious humanism. In fact, I am a life member of the Fellowship of UU Humanists, but I also support the UU Christian Fellowship, and my wife is a member of the UU Christian Fellowship. We have a mixed marriage, one Christian, one humanist. And when Scotty inscribed this copy of the book, he said, for Tony and Jody, with all my best to you two in your personal religious journeys and your interfaith life together. Scotty. But Scotty led on to me that he also supports the humanist organization, even though he puts his identity as Christian, but it's not all a supernaturalistic kind of Christianity. It's a reliance upon a sense of a power of good in the universe, but the teachings of Jesus as an ethical call as to how to live in the world. So humanists and Christians walking together, well, it's essential. And I want to give you an example of one outstanding Unitarian Christian and one outstanding Unitarian humanist walking together. These were two ministerial colleagues of mine, the Reverend Dean Starr, who died a few years ago, who was once the minister of the Unitarian Church in Summit, New Jersey, and the Reverend Carl Scoville, who was minister for more than 30 years at King's Chapel, and is now living in retirement in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, near his grandchildren at the age of 84. In 1994, so we're going back a few years, Carl Scoville gave what's known as the Berry Street Essay, which precedes the start of the UUA General Assembly, but is part of the ministers' meetings. But it's the last part of the ministers' meetings, and a lot of lay people arrive early to make sure they can attend it. It's a big deal. And Carl Scoville that year gave the essay on Beyond Spirituality. And what he was talking about there is that specific spiritual practices are not so important as a sense of there being a good intent at the heart of the universe. That is his notion of being a Unitarian Universalist Christian. There is a good intent at the heart of the universe, which some people would call God. And that was what his essay was about. But he said he was awfully dissatisfied with the essay as he was writing it and even as he presented it. Now, the essayist gets to pick one or two respondents. And the two respondents he picked were the Reverend Suzanne Spencer, who's a contemporary of mine, and we've known each other since before either of us went to divinity school. She's now known as the Reverend Suzanne Redfern Campbell. She's now minister in Taos, New Mexico. And the Reverend Dean Starr, whom I mentioned. And Dean and I were neighbors on Beacon Hill when I was in divinity school, and he was in a period of not working in congregational ministry for personal reasons. And Suzanne had been one of Carl Scoville's interns at King's Chapel. And Carl tells the story of Dean's response to his affirmation of the good intent at the heart of the universe and all the ways that he could explain that and find and exemplify it. And he used, and Carl explored Buddhist and other traditions other than Christianity in doing this. And this is, I'm going to quote from Scoville's account of this because I can't tell it as well as he does. The second respondent, Dean Starr, friend of more than 30 years. So get this, we've already got a humanist and a Christian walking together for 30 years here. Agnostic and iconoclast, he spoke. I can only paraphrase what he said. It went something like this. Carl says that he sees goodness at the heart of the universe. I don't see that at all. I look into the universe and all I see is conflict and indifference. A sublime indifference to our human species, or any other species for that matter. Dean went on with the grand eloquence of a Robert Ingersoll and other great naysayers. Then he described going to Portland, Oregon for his son's funeral. And after the service, going on an evening cruise. Dean said, I didn't find peace in a church or in a prayer. I looked into the sunset and I found peace there. Then Dean took a tack I did not expect. He said, I'm now going to lead you in singing a hymn. It's a hymn I learned as a child in the Nazarene church. You don't have the words in front of you, but I'll bet you know it. And then he started singing. I come to the garden alone while the dew is still on the roses. And the voice I hear falling on my ear, the Son of God discloses. And then the chorus. And he walks with me and he talks with me and he tells me I am his own. And the joy we share as we tarry there, none other has ever known. Carl goes on, I was wondering to myself, what is Dean doing? Why is he singing this hymn? Dean pitched right into the second verse, which no one knew as he sang it alone, until we joined him in the chorus. Dean was right. Almost everybody knew it. Well, it was quite a sight and quite a sound to see and hear 400 Unitarian Universalist ministers and spouses singing an old chestnut like In the Garden. And this isn't the end of the story. Here I'm going to compress it a bit. Earlier that day, there had been a presentation by Tex Sample as a minister in the United Church of Christ, and a renowned storyteller, and that's what his presentation was about, storytelling in ministry. And he and Sample, and both Carl and Dean missed that. They knew nothing about it because they were squirreled away in their rooms writing and writing and writing. You know, talk about last-minute preparation. And since Carl Scovel couldn't get his new laptop to work, he did it all longhand with a ballpoint pen and then got it photocopied for his respondents. And Tex Samples, apparently, though, had talked about that hymn and how much he hated it and its sentimentality and its triteness. And in giving a talk to a group of fundamentalists, he sang it in a falsetto to make fun of it. And after his talk, a woman came up to him and said, "I want to tell you something about that hymn. From the time I was about 10 years old until I was about 14, my father raped me almost every day of my life. After he finished, I'd put on my clothes and go out into the backyard, and I'd walk around the yard slowly, and I'd sing that hymn. It was the only thing that kept me sane, the only thing that kept me from killing myself. Because when I sang that hymn, I knew I was somebody. I hope you'll remember that the next time you sing it." And this explained why Carl and Dean, sitting up on the platform, had noticed everyone crying during the hymn. They had all heard that story this morning. As had Carl's wife, Faith, who didn't tell him about it because he was too busy writing. And Dean had called Carl in Boston a week later to tell him about it. And that's why the people were crying. And Faith apparently still hadn't told Carl about it. But, you know, they're still married 60 years, so it's fine. It works. Then going back to Carl's narrative. And Dean hung up. After Dean hung up, I realized why I had felt the lecture was incomplete. It was incomplete. The lecture alone could not make the point. It took that song to complete it. And that gave me a new angle on Unitarian Universalism. It's a community where Christians give the lectures and humanists sing the hymns. Now, that may not be your experience, but I'll tell you, at three or four general assemblies late at night, you'd find a bunch of people in the hospitality suite, and Dean Starr would be leading them in old hymns, and you have 20 people with their arms around each other singing hymns they would never allow in a place like this on Sunday morning, as lay people and ministers both. The Christians give lectures and the humanists lead hymns. Okay. On one level, that's a flippant description, but on another, it's a recognition that reason is not the exclusive property of any one belief system, nor, for that matter, is emotion that the singing embodies the possession of solely one belief system. And finally, that the boundaries are, as Conrad Wright says, sometimes fuzzy, but within those boundaries, wonderful things can happen. And the space that was allowed that day at the General Assembly allowed wonderful things to happen with people who didn't know all the pieces all the time. So humanists and Christians, Unitarians all walking together. Well, Dean and Carl did that over nearly 40 years of friendship until Dean died. And also walking together, Hindus, Buddhists, Taoists, pagans, goddess worshipers, Unitarians all, we can walk together because we choose to walk together. But as we do draw boundaries because not everyone will be able to engage in a tradition with which they identify and one that is liberal and says basically not that they're all the same, but that they are all equally valid. And that is the heart of the consensus we have to walk together. Unitarians, whether Christians, humanists, Buddhists, whatever. A deep and abiding, not just tolerance, but respect for and appreciation of the other traditions that fit within our broad consensus. And may we live so that is true. Amen and blessed be.